Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Lynn MacDonald on They Called It Passchendaele.
I was quite interested in reading the programme and the part which was introducing this talk to see that I'm expected to give you a fresh insight into the Battle of Passchendaele. I think all I can give you is my own insight, such as it is, because despite much revisionism over the years, I have changed it very little. As you can see, I'm very old. And there are you can also see that there are certain disadvantages in being very old. However, there was one great advantage, which is that when I was starting this work, there were still soldiers of the First World War around. So I was able to go to the horse's mouth, so to speak. And the horses neighed obligingly. And that was really how I started. Before that, I had no idea even of being an historian of anything. I was a journalist, and I worked with the BBC. And I happened to hear of a group of old soldiers, just by chance I heard, who were going back to the battlefields for the last time. And they'd been going since 1928. I can't quite remember what year it was. I think it was 72 or 73. So naturally, I immediately thought, gosh, this would make a great half-hour documentary. So I went to see our head of programs and suggested this idea to him, and he thought it was good. And he kindly funded it to the extent of £30 of the BBC's money. I told you it was a long time ago. And I phoned up the organizer of this trip and said that I'd very much like to come. And he said, oh yes, anyone who likes can come with us. So I duly turned up at Victoria Station on Saturday morning, complete with tape recorder and the said £30, and met these chaps. That was the beginning of one of the most remarkable weeks of my life. They were the Old Comrades Association of the 13th Service Battalion, the Rifle Brigade, Kitchener's Army. And they were organized by a marvelous chap called Bert Thorne, who was their Hon Sec. And he had met a couple of comrades up at the Rifle Brigade Memorial in 1928, or 27, I think. And they had decided, the three of them, having gone for a beer afterwards, naturally, it was Armistice Day, and that they would like to go back and see where they had been. And so he organized it for the next year, for the three of them. Many years later, in the 1970s, he was still taking a party twice a year. They alternated. One year they went to Somme, the next year to Passchendaele, or Ypres, rather, I should say. And on the third year, and this was it, they went to a place called Monchy-le-Preux. Anyone ever heard of it? Mm-hmm. Oh, good. I hadn't at that time. And it was part of their action in the Battle of Arras. It was a very minor action. Until that point, what I knew about the First World War was not a great deal. Well, obviously, I'd read all the books, knew a bit of poetry, heard the songs, and had a few received ideas, and that was about it. But these chaps were telling me things that I'd never heard, and things that I never knew. And I had a marvelous time with them. And the first one, as I said, was to Monchy, so we all arrived at Ostend. And they spoke, they chatted, and talked among themselves too, because there was something that seemed about being together which seemed to spark them off. And I think probably what it was is that for years, whenever they said anything about it, someone would say, oh God, there's Father going on about how he won the First World War again. And no one had really listened to them. But with their own comrades, they were able to talk and have a laugh and remember things. And it was, it was poignant. The beginning was poignant. We went off in the coach, then we went to Ostend, and the next day we went in the coach down into France to Arras and beyond to Monty, which is a little place between Arras and the Somme, on top of a hill. It was a minor action, but it was very important to them. The coach took us up to the top of a hill. We got off, a very steep hill, and at the top there was a big pillbox, German fortification, covered with ivy and looking somewhat picturesque. And the first thing was that one of them said, that's where they had a machine gun. All the time we were coming up this hill, it was Easter Monday, 10th of April, snowing like blazes. And all the time we were coming up, we went up behind the cavalry, and all we could see were horses with no riders dashing back down the hill and bodies everywhere. That was the first thing I heard. And it was obviously very important to all of them. We walked to it's where the Rifle Brigade Memorial is, so we walked to the memorial. They laid a wreath. We were all very quiet for a while. And then we walked to the Salle de Fête, where there was a great reception, and the mood entirely changed. The champagne flowed. There were speeches in bowdlerized French and pidgin English. Nobody understood a word, but everybody seemed to understand each other. And as soon as the glass was empty, it was filled again. There was singing. They had the most wonderful time, and the villagers were obviously very pleased to see them. And you could see two guys conversing, one French who didn't speak any English, one English who didn't speak any French, but somehow or other they were having a conversation. And it was just like it must have been the war, that we would hear things like saying, compris? No? Oui. That was about it, but they somehow knew what they were talking about, and it was clear that there was a terrific bond between them. So when we went back in the coach, again the mood was pretty relaxed, shall we say. I remember Fred White took out his mouth organ, and he took out his teeth, the better to play it. And they started singing war songs, which were quite unfamiliar to me. I mean, I knew the tune, but not the words. They were quite different. And they had an extremely jolly time all the way back. However, it was a most extraordinary week, because naturally I interviewed them all, and they were all very anxious to talk, and they were very generous with their recollections and with their tales. And the important thing then, as now, was to listen. And the more you listened, the more you heard. And they were remarkable. So over the next few months, I was preparing this program, which was called Last Trip to Monchy, and is still lurking somewhere in the archives of BBC, I imagine. And it was a good program. It was good. It worked. It won a prize. Sony prize, you know, it wasn't a big deal. But they were very pleased with it. I even got Fred White, he of the mouth organ, to present it. He was a real cockney, and he was really good. He was a natural. And he did the links in the program, and it was all, they were very pleased. And it was while I was doing this that I realized that this was a view and a truth which had not really been told before. And it was all new to me, and I was fairly clued up about things in those days. But it hadn't been documented. And, well, over the course of that work, I thought that I would like to write a book from their point of view and to tell that truth which I had learned. I don't mean truth in the sense of anything pompous, just the view. And that was the start. It was quite a complicated process, because obviously it wasn't just the old soldiers, and I had to find a lot of other old soldiers, and they were very good about that. Say, oh, I got a pal in Leeds, so-and-so, and he was with us, or he was with another battalion, and I gradually accumulated them. They also advertised were you at Ypres in 1917, and in places where people retired, people like places like Worthing, where my own mother had retired and lived at the time, and various other places like that. So I had soon many hundreds of replies. They were obviously very keen to be a part of this. And I then got on with it, started talking to them, started interviewing, went all over the country. But I didn't want to write an oral history, and it actually slightly gets up my nose when people describe my work as an oral history, because I just feel that it's another point of view, the experience of war, and I think the experience of war is what matters. Why Passchendaele? Well, when you think of the First World War, there are three words that seem to come back and haunt people over the years. Somme, Verdun, especially for the French, and Passchendaele. Now, Passchendaele was not the objective of the battle. Passchendaele was an insignificant village on the top of the ridges that surround the old city of Ypres, medieval city surrounded by its ramparts, down in the low ground, the ridges round about. It's been described as like a saucer with Ypres in the hollow in the middle and the ridges going up round about it and enclosing it, almost enclosing it. This was the Ypres salient. It wasn't meant to be captured. That wasn't the object of the exercise. It was just going to be a staging post on the road to victory. It didn't feature in the original battle plan. The idea was quite different. It had a strategy and it had an object, which is more than the Somme did, for example. I mean, they weren't going anywhere except just to break the line and to support the French and to support Nivelle and so on. But here, the idea was to break out of the salient, get over the ridges, down into the plain, capture the German railhead, advance a bit to the north, and swing round and capture the ports of Ostend and Zeebrugge from the rear while there was an amphibious attack from the sea. Why that? Because we were losing a tremendous amount of shipping and by U-boat action in the Atlantic. And of course, as an island, we desperately relied on ships and bringing in supplies and food and everything. But that was in 1916. And Haig, who had just become commander-in-chief, was very keen on this. And I mean, as a soldier, as a military man, you could see that it was a good idea, a great real objective. But the fact was that by 1917, the shipping losses had diminished very considerably because the convoy system had been introduced. So there was less of a reason, really, to do this great strategic plan of breaking out and capturing the ports. And in any event, actually, I rather think that the U-boats were not necessarily operating from there, that they might have been using it for refueling or whatever, but it was really further north in the estuary of Hamburg and in that area where the U-boats were operating. So a year had elapsed between the conception of the plan and the opportunity to launch it, though Haig had been obliged again in the Nivelle offensive to participate in the Battle of Arras, which is where Monchy came in, and that was in the spring. So it was well into the summer before they were able to start this. I mean, well in, 31st of July was the beginning. And they could have done it earlier and should, I think, though it's very arrogant, really, in hindsight, to say things like that. But they had the Battle of Messines, where they'd been working for years driving tunnels and to get the Germans off the ridge. They were going to blow up 21 great, huge mines under the ridge. Battle of Messines, they did it, and it worked, and the army advanced. This is alongside the salient. If you can imagine a question mark, the Ypres salient would, very roughly, the Ypres salient would be the bulge of the top half of the question mark, and the Messines Ridge, the line along the bottom. So it was an enormous success. But the army advanced a bit, but there was nowhere to go because there was still the salient on the left. Had they been able to attack then, this is the 7th of June, it would have had a very good chance of success because they'd really rattled the Germans' teeth, or the teeth of the enemy. Sorry, I'm laughing because I must really stop saying the Germans, because one of our grandsons quite recently said, you know, I've just been to Dusseldorf and I've changed my opinion about the Germans. They're really quite nice. So that gave us not only a laugh, but pause for thought. I thought, how has he got this idea? Of course, they'd all been up to the battlefields and liked it. But anyway, we'll say the enemy, shall we? The fact that the enemy were Germans, you can work out for yourselves. In the interval between the planning of the battle in 1916 and its execution in 1917, the enemy had been building, and they were terrific engineers. First of all, when they picked a line, they wouldn't necessarily want to bang up against the enemy, in that case, but they would choose a line which had more strategic position on a higher ridge where they overlooked or they could defend much more easily. Excuse me while I have a slug of this. It is not gin. And they were busy building, and all over the salient they had built these great pillboxes. Now, I've seen one in a cross-section when it was being demolished with great difficulty, and the walls were really that thick, and the concrete was poured around a framework of very strong mesh of steel wires, or iron wires, but it was enormous, thick wire like that. And you would look at it and think that, I mean, they were almost impervious to shellfire. Though they would rattle your teeth, but I think that you would survive inside. So by the time they actually launched the battle on the 31st of July, you will realize that almost 2 months have elapsed since the 7th of June when they had managed in the Battle of Messines. And so they had lost the advantage of surprise, which they knew perfectly well something was going to happen. And it was very late in the season, but they reckoned it was the first time that they could do that. And it wasn't just, though, the idea of getting the Channel ports. There was also Ypres to defend, the Channel ports of Ostend and Zeebrugge. You couldn't go up the coast because the land had been flooded. It's like Holland, most of it under sea level. It had been flooded in 1914 to stem the German advance. And so the only way to do it was to try and break out of this. But there was also Ypres. Now, Ypres was very important. It might surprise you to know that I can tell you exactly how far away Ypres is. From the Cenotaph in Whitehall to the Cloth Hall in Ypres is exactly 138 miles and 560 yards. That's not very far away from home. And from London, from the coast, much, much nearer. Coincidentally, it's 139 miles from Salisbury to Cambridge, where my husband and I drove down yesterday. It struck me as a coincidence, really, that almost exactly, and it only took us 4 hours, with doing it very leisurely. So it was pretty, pretty close. And Ypres was defending the other Channel ports, Calais and Dunkirk. Now, to drive from Dunkirk to Ypres takes exactly, driving very leisurely, 40 miles an hour, so even using the motorway, is 25 minutes. Calais is not much longer. So it's It was a lifeline, and that was the lifeline. They didn't have much troop movement through Calais, and none through Dunkirk, because it was too close. It was almost within long-range shell fire. Most of the troop movement was through Boulogne, but supplies were absolutely vital. Now, it really was the lifeline to England, and I think statistics are very boring, but some of these are quite staggering. It was an army which moved on horsepower much more than any other. It was many cases in which only horses could get to the places that they required to go, no roads. It took 40 shiploads, boatloads of forage every day to feed the horses. 40 shiploads going into Calais or Dunkirk. It took 100 tons of horseshoes per week. That had to come over. And not only that, but all the food for the army and the post, every roll of wire, every necessity from stone to mending the roads, down to the last nail and horseshoe. All had to come in through those ports. So Ypres was important. It got to hold on to Ypres, because where the Germans were, that advantage they have, they could have jumped down and been through Ypres in no time at all. They didn't do that, but we still had to hold on to it. Even though by that time, 1917, it was very badly knocked about. And you would think, what's the use of defending this? But it was, in fact, the bulwark which defended the important channel forts from our point of view. Ammunition, of course, came by that route. I mean, quite a lot came to Le Havre. But, and in 19, I'll tell you a story, in 1915, they had brought in a great deal of ammunition and a lot of, you can imagine the amount of dynamite, if that's what it was, or explosive that you needed for to explode the whole of the Messines Ridge. Tons and tons, hundreds of tons. But even before that, they needed to, they were trying to, if anyone's been to Ypres, I'm sure some of you have, you know the great crater that's on the Hooge Ridge outside the Hooge Chateau. And this was actually the apex of the salient, and they really had to secure this. So that it was captured and held with difficulty, but there were German fortifications round about, and the engineering officer, Major Cowan, was very anxious to blow these up. But as I explained to you, they were so immensely strong, it was very difficult. So he had heard that there was a new explosive, Aminol, and that there was a supply. He knew there was a supply in France. Someone had told him on the grapevine that it had come. I say France, to the army, Belgium and France, it was all France. They didn't really make much distinction. So he indented for this. It was a high explosive, I'd have to decrib here, made of ammonium nitrite and aluminium. That might mean something to some of you. It doesn't mean much to me, except I know it was a pretty strong explosive, and he wanted it. So he indented for this Aminol nearly, I can't remember how many pounds, but it amounted to almost 2 tons. Well, the quartermaster general was astonished at this, so the corps commander sent it to the quartermaster general, said, "What is this stuff?" And he had no idea, so he sent it to the chief medical officer to see if he knew what it was. And the answer came back: Aminol is a sensual sedative used to subdue cases of abnormal sexual excitement. He had ordered almost 2 tons of it for a tunneling company of 300 men. But the MO apparently added thoughtfully that so far as he knew, there had not yet been any such cases in 5 Corps. So he got his Aminol, though. He was confusing Aminol and Aminil. And Aminol was the explosive, and Aminil was the the other thing, which I just told you about. I suppose this was the precise opposite of Viagra, I don't know. But the soldiers hated the Ypres salient, and, you know, you can well understand. If you stand in the Ypres salient, well, in the winter, even if you're not being shot at and shells exploding, and if you're perfectly safe and you're standing on, say, Hill 60, there is a damp cold that penetrates right into your bones. Now, the soldiers, of course, did not have a nice warm cafe to retire to, as one used to scuttle to. I had to go very often in the winter because that's the only way you can put the battle on the ground. You can't, when the crops are down, you can't see anything if they're up. And so I had spent a lot of time in the winter, and it really gave you an idea of what it was like and to experience what matters, which was just the sheer discomfort of it, apart from anything else. And as far as I'm concerned, in any history of the Great War, it's the experience of the men who took part that illuminates events. It's almost like switching on a light in a dark room, and suddenly you're there, you're sharing it with them, you can hear them. But the fog of war is no idle phrase, because no frontline soldier knew what was happening to 5 yards the right of him or 5 yards the left of him. All he knew was his own particular experience. So there's no point in asking one who took part in the battle even what was happening. He hadn't any idea. He only knew what was happening to him. He only knew what was happening to his platoon, what was happening to his mates. But it's that kind of detail, sometimes a very tiny thing, that enables you almost to reach out your hand and touch it, or be touched by something trivial that makes you understand. And it wasn't all gloom and doom. There was one chap, Sergeant Butler, and he told me a story. He said, it was my first guard as Lance Corporal, and I took the responsibility very keen. About 2 a.m., the sentry reported to me that a 36-gallon barrel of Vin Blanc was stood on a cart at the back of the estaminet. Well, we couldn't see the sense of it being out in the cold all night, so we decided to move it. We got some old rags out of the warehouse we were billeted in, and a brush. It took 5 of us to get it off the wagon, and we rolled the barrel on bags all the way to well past the village. The one man swept the road behind so you couldn't see the track of the barrel. It was very clever, I think. When we got to the well, the lads took a drink just to confirm that it was Vin Blanc. Then we put the bung back and lowered it down the well with some ropes and a chain attached to the well handle. Next morning, I had trouble getting the guard up. About 9 o'clock, 2 gendarmes came and said to our surprise that they'd lost a barrel of wine. Well, naturally, we helped them look for it. Well, they searched here and they searched there, and they even looked in the well. We watched them look down the well, but there wasn't a Sherlock Holmes among them. The following night, we pulled the barrel up to see how it had fared, and you never saw such a game. But that was the last of it for our lads. We went back up the line next night, and we never saw the barrel again. We never got back to that billet again, and that was the trouble. I remember one soldier who told me with great indignation of a comrade who was put on a charge for leaving half a biscuit on the, I don't know, the parapet or the fire step in a trench when they were being relieved. And it wasn't until I read the memoir of a Captain McQueen, who was sanitary officer of the Highland Division, that I fully realized why he'd been put on a charge and the importance of cleanliness, because there were rats everywhere, and of course rats carried disease. Empty tins chucked over the parapet were extremely dangerous, because not only would it encourage rats if there was any food in them, but they made a noise, and if you were sending a patrol out and they had to get through the wire and go through this and it clinked, that would be it. They would give their the fact away that they were leaving the trench and they were alert the enemy. So what they had to do was take the rubbish and bury it neatly behind the line. Pretty difficult to do in the Ypres salient where you had mud everywhere, but in the Somme they did, and sometimes was road widening. You can see a neat little bundle the side of the road. I saw one once, and it had obviously the contents of some parcels from home. There were sort of wrappers from Kendall mint cake and some empty tins of Bourneville cocoa, things that were all very neat, you know, thing. And the machinery of the road had exposed it there. It was quite touching, really, to see it after so very many years. But Captain McQueen, also I read his memoir, this sanitary officer, that I realised that the importance of that. It was his enemy, it wasn't the Kaiser, it wasn't the Germans, it wasn't the war, it was the fly. He was obsessive about flies, and he made an absolute nuisance of himself with his demands for the things that should be done in the trenches. But he did something rather marvellous. He invented the self-closing latrine. Now, this was important because there's latrine sap in the trench and latrine at the end of it. And it was a dangerous thing to go to the loo, especially in the summer. Naturally, flies congregated in that particular place. And when a man went there, the flies lifted up in a cloud above it. And a handy sniper would just keep his rifle trained there and knock off whoever was there. And a lot of men died like that. I really do think, and I'm not being flippant, that that is the derivation of the expression to be caught with your pants down. So Captain McQueen was an unsung hero, and he saved a lot of lives because the casualties reduced. Going back to the old soldiers, I don't think I've left them actually. You have to be very careful. You have got to be able to recognise an old soldier's tale, and I've heard a few of those in my time. And you can't take liberties or guess. Now, that story I told you about Sergeant Butler and the barrel of Vin Blanc, as they called it, was written to me. He wrote an account of it. And another one, which was written, it came from Canada. So obviously, I had a lot from overseas where I couldn't go myself. You've got, I nearly fell on my nose with this one. You have to be very, very careful. Now, I'm going to read it to you. This was by that time, Passchendaele was churned up and muddy awfulness, and these Canadians were almost on the topmost ridge because they eventually did capture the village of Passchendaele, or what remained of it, which were a few dust heaps and bricks. And he was called Leonard Williams, and he was with the Canadian Battalion. And he was with Stokes Mortar Brigade, and it was absolutely useless at that point. Stokes Mortars would just send up a fountain of mud and spray, and there was not worthwhile. So they took them off this team and made them stretcher bearers. So he said, the whole place looked like something out of hell. We were all under fire all the time, and we just slugged along carrying the stretchers, hoping for the best. One of the lads from the battery caught up with us and walked along with us. I knew him, we called him Zippo. In a lull in the shelling, as we waded through all this muck and mire, he said to me, what's your hometown? Ottawa, I replied. He said, same here. Then he looked around at the mess everywhere, and after a pause he said, believe it or not, I was manager of the F-Theatre. Now, I thought this was a good story. There's a bit more to it than that. And being not unfamiliar with the veteran's favourite adjective, which was ubiquitous in the army, I filled in the appropriate word. And I wrote it just exactly as he said it, with a slight alteration, said I was manager of the fucking theatre, which is what I was sure he said. Well, when the book came out, or the proofs came out, and I sent them to him to say, this is what we're going to publish, is it all right? I got a letter back, and he said, that's absolutely fine. I was much amused at your choice of adjective. As a matter of fact, he said, I put the F-dash theatre because I couldn't remember if it was the Follies or the Frivolity. However, he added, please don't change it, because it's very much how we were at the time.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.